Okay, excellent. Sorry, I apologize for the technical difficulties. Let's get started. We're running a little late already, and we haven't even started. I think tonight's going to be a very exciting night. Excuse me. And let's get started, because there are actually two developments that just happened today, perfectly timed, that'll make things even more interesting. Our topic for tonight is new ways, new books, new methodologies of studying Tanakh. Let me pull up the list. Here are some books that we'll discuss. There's a lot to discuss because this is a growing literature in English specifically about this topic, about the new ways that things have developed over time in learning Tanakh. Really, the new approaches probably started in the early 1800s with Shadal, Shmuel David Luzzatto, who was a fascinating individual who was really radical in his new ways of thinking about how to learn Tanakh. Truthfully, he's fairly traditional in his views. Well, maybe not that traditional, but certainly orthodox. But he had just a new way of looking at things. And you should start all discussions of new ways of learning Tanakh with Shadal. Before him, prior to him, was Moses Mendelssohn with his Beer, a commentary on the Chumash. But that's actually very traditional, surprisingly. People were opposed to it. He was a controversial man. But if you look at the commentary in his Beer, it's actually very traditional. So he really does not belong in any discussion of new ways of learning Tanakh. Now, starting from Shadal and moving on in the 1800s, there were a lot of very new and interesting people. There was the Malbim, there was Rav David Zvi Hoffman, there was the Netziv. But we're not going to start with that. We're going to start with someone in the 20th century who was revolutionary in a very quiet way, and her name was Nechama Leibowitz. There was recently, there's a new biography, actually two new biographies of her that were recently published. One in Hebrew, which I haven't seen, but supposedly excellent, and one in English, which I have. It's about 600 pages, very long, very detailed, excellent book. Before we discuss that, let me just point out the other. We have five on the list here that we're going to be discussing. The second is Rabbi Yitzhak Echelom's Between the Lines of the Bible. I helped publish that. I was very involved with that book. Number three, Rabbi Moshe Lichtenstein's Moses, Envoy of His People. That's Rabbi Moshe Lichtenstein. He's the son of Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein. Rabbi Moshe was recently appointed as one of the new Koresh Yeshivas of Yeshiva Atar Zion in Gush Etzion. And then we have the last number four and five, both by Rabbi Chaim Angel, from Manhattan, through an opaque lens, and his most recent one called Revealed Text Hidden Meanings, which just came out very recently. moving to the first book to discuss Nechama Leibowitz and how radical in some way like to be called Nechama. That's why I'm referring to her by her first name. I'm certainly not on a first name basis with her. I never met her, never saw her. This is the cover of the English biography recently done by Yael Unterman. I think it took about 10 years to research it. Very detailed, there's a lot to say on the book. But just to talk about Nechama and her approach to Tanakh, the way she did it was very different from what you're used to, and what I'm used to, learning in school and in yeshiva. Normally we do it word by word, verse by verse. Nechama looked at things a little bigger than that. She looked at passage by passage. She broadened the scope so that instead of focusing on each word where the commentaries address them, she focused on passages. But more than that, she focused on text, on pshat, on a simple meaning, a simple understanding. She also brought into the discussion literary styles. When you're looking at larger passages, rather than individual words and individual verses, you look at the themes and the styles, who's talking, and I studied under some of her students when I was in high school, and one of the things that I was introduced to, really in ninth grade, and kept coming up again and again, was this thing called a chiasmus. It's like an X. You see things repeated in a style, go like ABBA. First, there's one statement, then following it is another theme, and then that theme is repeated in a different way, and then it goes back to the original theme. So with that pattern, that chiasmus pattern, those types of patterns are something that Nechama brought into the study of Tanakh, and she and her students took it very far from there. And other things that Nechama introduced proposed or used a lot was discussing the patriarchs, not only the patriarchs, but all the characters in the Bible, their humanity, the psychology, the ideas and the themes and the reasons and their motivations and what they were feeling, treating them like real human beings. Now, this is, again, this is not something that she innovated herself. This is something that can be found in traditional sources, but it's something that she brought to the fore, and she dealt with a lot. There's also criticism of the Bible, of the characters in the Bible. Did they do things wrong? This is not something new on her behalf, on her part either, but it is somewhat controversial, because in the study of Tanakh, really, what you hear nowadays are two types of schools. One is a school from the Musar movement. The Musar movement, they were very opposed to attributing any possible flaw in characters of the Bible. I mean, you can see it very much so in the writings of the Alter of Slobodka. He was the Musar master from the Yeshiva of Slobodka, who trained many of the Rosh Yeshiva that came to America and led the Yeshiva movement in America. When people discuss this issue, they talk about Rav Aaron Cutler. Rav Aaron Cutler was very opposed to finding any flaws in any characters in the Bible, but the truth is Rav Aaron Cutler got it from his Rebbe, who was the Alter of Slobodka. On the other hand, you see other people like Rav Shimshon Rafael Hirsch, who sees flaws in the characters of the Bible. Not major flaws, we're not talking turning them into raving lunatics or maniacs, but finding human flaws, mistakes that people make. And Rav Shimshon Rafael Hirsch, he lived in the mid to late 1800s, he didn't innovate this either. This can be found going back very far. But again, when we talk about criticism of the patriarchs, of characters of the Bible, you have to differentiate between what we're talking about, whether we talk about mild criticism, in which you find, you're talking about great people who may have made mistakes or may have had character flaws, and then radical criticism, in which you're basically trashing the characters of the Bible, that Rav Shimshon Rafael Hirsch certainly didn't do, Nechama Leibowitz certainly didn't do. You can find that occasionally, but that's not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about is respectful criticism, and the kind that the Ramban would do. So that is something that you will find in Nechama Leibowitz's teachings. interestingly enough, and this is something we're going to come back to again, Nechama Leibowitz was aware of biblical criticism, and in some ways she responded to it, but she never discussed it from what I've seen. She did not discuss it directly. She did not discuss it head-on. She did not say, the Bible critics say this, but I disagree because of this, this, and this. That's not how she did it, and we'll see in a minute how she actually did it. And it was very subtle. If you didn't know what she was talking about, you might not get it. But if you did know what she was talking about, you'd see how powerful her approach was. Nechama, she quoted non-traditional sources, which was unique. You won't find that in most Bible commentaries. You won't find them quoting, you will occasionally, Ibn Ezra will, Abarbanel will to some degree, but certainly contemporary. You won't find Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky quoting Reform Bible scholars. But Nechama did. She quoted Jacob Benno very frequently. He was a Reform scholar. Martin Buber. She quoted Moses Mendelssohn, who, again, he was Orthodox, but he was controversial. She had no problem quoting him. Shadow, Rav David Zvi Hoffman. Rav David Zvi Hoffman has impeccable Orthodox credentials, but his commentary on the Bible was very modern, very academic, looking at it from the perspective of a biblical critic, even though that's who he was responding to. He was upholding the Bible in response to biblical critics, but he was within that whole framework of academic framework, and again, so you won't see people like Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky quoting him. Nechama Leibowitz felt entirely comfortable quoting any of these non-traditional and even non-Orthodox scholars. probably the most glaring, most prominent characteristic of Nechama Leibowitz's approach was that she dealt with mainly the interaction between the commentaries, the commentators, and the text itself. So she would approach the text, look for the issues, the problem that the commentators saw, and how that caused the commentators to reach their conclusions. So, for example, you and me, when we were in elementary school or in high school, we'd read a Rashi or a Ramban, and we would see them saying, well, this means this and this means that, and then we'd move on. But Nechama innovated a new approach in which you would look at the Ramban, you would look at Rashi and say, why did Rashi say this? Why did Ramban say this? Her famous phrase was, Makashela Rashi. What was bothering Rashi that he had to say this? What was bothering the Ramban that he had to say this? And the way she would approach the commentaries is she would quote commentary after commentary, explaining what they saw in the text that drove them to say those comments. And then she would have them argue with each other. Even though they were lived in over hundreds of years apart in different parts of the world, she would have Rashi and Ibn Ezra or Ramban or the Sfarno or other people from throughout the ages arguing and debating which is the best pshat in the Chumash, which or in Tanakh, which is the best way to read Tanakh. Now, you know, when I think of that, I think of it as this great passage. A lot of people quote Rabbi Soloveitchik. He used to talk about how when he was a kid and he would learn and he would see, he would imagine, you know, all these different commentaries on the Talmud coming into the room together and arguing. Rashi arguing with the Rambam, arguing with the Ramban and the Rashba. What I thought of, maybe because I'm not as from as some other people, what I thought of was this novel by Chaim Potok. Chaim Potok used to be years ago, was a student in Yeshiva University, and he left and he went to the Conservative Seminary at JTS. And he wrote a lot of great novels with some semi-autobiographical statements and stories in there. So he has one story about, in one of his books, I think it was called In the Beginning, which is largely about someone grappling with biblical criticism and basically leaving the Orthodox faith. Because of that, again, probably semi-autobiographical, but what he talks about is when he was a student learning with his Bible tutor, how the Bible tutor would bring the commentaries up live, and he'd see the Ibn Ezra arguing with Rashi, who's going to win, who is the better proof, and then the Ramban gets into it and refutes the Ibn Ezra. That's when I read Nechama Leibowitz's, her Iyunim, her studies on the Torah, that's what I see. I see the different commentators battling it out, who has a better pshat, who has a better proof for what the simple reading of the text is. So let's move on to an example of one of Nechama's studies, and we'll see a little bit about her approach. Okay, this example is taken from a parsha a few weeks ago. It is about the war between there was a war between various kings, and Avram came in and saved some kings, and then the king of Sodom came to Avram to thank him. So it's in Bereishis Perek Yudalet, Genesis 14. Vayitzei Melech Sodom likrasso acharei shuvo mehakoses k'tar l'omer v'yatzam lachim asher ito el emek shaveh hu emek ha-melech. So the king of Sodom came out to greet Avram after he just defeated all those enemies. So that was Pasuk Yud Zayin. Pasuk Yud Ches, Umaki Tzedek, Melch Shalem, Hotzi Lechem, Beyayin, Vu Kohen, Lekel Elyon. Should have said Hashem's name, but I didn't. So you see, Pesukim Yud Ches Techof here are the story of Malki Tzedek, the king of Shalem, going to Avram, bringing him bread and wine. Vayevarcheu, Vayomer, Baruch Avram, Baruch Avram, Le'el Elyon, Kone Shemayin, V'aretz, Baruch El Elyon, Asher, Magen Sarecha biyadecha biiten lo maaser mikol. So this is an exchange between Avram and Malki Tzedek, and then Pasuk Chafalef goes Vayomer Melech Sodom el Avram ten li hanefesh baruchosh kach loch, and then immediately go back to a conversation between Avram and the king of Sodom. So the question is, what is the story of Malki Tzedek doing in the middle of the discussion of the exchange between the king of Sodom and Avram? So Nechama Leibowitz, first she starts out with two possible commentaries to explain this, each of them discussing it, saying that the story of Malki Tzedek is coming to teach us something about the king of Sodom. According to the Abarbanel, the king of Sodom would not have asked for anything, right? Because Avram just saved him. Why would he come to Avram and ask him, you know, give me all the people who you conquered, but you keep all the booty, you keep all the money, all the possessions, but I'll get all the slaves from the people you conquered. What kind of a chutzpah is that? Avram just saved him. So how could the king of Sodom even think to ask Avram for anything? So the Barbanel says, well, He just saw the whole story of Melchizedek. The king of Salem saw how generous Avram was, and therefore he decided to try to take advantage of that generosity. So the story of Melchizedek is trying to explain to us why the king of Salem would ask Avram for anything. The Or HaChaim says it a little differently. He says it's to show a contrast between the king of Salem and Melchizedek, that the king of Salem, who should have been grateful, comes and asks for something, while Melchizedek, who had no reason to be grateful, came out and gave bread and wine. So we see, by contrast, how wicked the king of Sodom was. So those are two possible commentaries of what was kasha for them. What drew them out, drew those comments out from those commentators is the juxtaposition. It's really the interpolation of this story of Melchizedek in the middle of the story of the king of Sodom. But there are two other approaches. The Rashbam, again, this is in the Chama Leibowitz Sefer order, so it's out of chronological order because the Rashbam was really the earliest of all of them. They go from Abarbanel to a later Or HaChaim, back to Rashbam, who was earlier. So Rashbam says it was to show that Avram was honest, because when he's talking to the king of Sodom at the end, Avram says, I don't want to take anything from you. The only thing I'm taking from you is that some of the young men ate from you. So the Rashbam is saying, what do you mean? They just had a war. They didn't eat anything? So no, the answer is Melchizedek came and gave them food. And the whole story of Melchizedek is to teach us that Avram was honest, and that when he said, I didn't eat anything from you, he was telling the truth. So it's coming to teach us about Avram. The Ramban, he explained that it's to show us about the faith of Avram compared to Melchizedek, that Avram was a true monotheist, because it's Avram refers to Baruch Kel Elyon. He praises Hashem, the uppermost God, while Melchizedek refers to, saying this wrong. Okay, so Melchizedek refers to Kel Elyon Konei Shamayim V'Aretz, to the upper God who owned the master of the heavens and the earth. So here he refers to a God who is the master, but not the creator, while Avram instead refers to Hashem Kel Elyon. It looks like I messed up on this this handout here. It says Baruch Hashem Kel Elyon, and so Avram is referring to just as one God, so Avram was a monotheist, while Melchizedek, I'm probably not giving this the justice that it deserves, but the Ramban explains it, and the Chama Leibowitz explains it further. Melchizedek is not a pure monotheist, while Avram is, and this is to come to teach us about the monotheism of Avram. So this is interesting for a number of reasons. Number one, it's Nechama showing us what the commentators said to explain this. What the commentators said, number one. Number two, why did they say it? Because of the problem with the text, and how, after you see the commentaries, the text makes perfect sense. Before you see the commentaries, it's very questionable why this story interrupts the other story. But furthermore, another reason why this is interesting, which Nechama doesn't tell us at all, is that this was something that bothered the biblical critics. And some of them, in the old times, Hermann Gunkel and Westerman, so they all saw this as an interpolation. They saw the verses, Psukim Yudches Tachav, verses 18 to 20, as some later source that was stuck in the middle, in the middle of the story of Melech Sodom. And Nechama came to refute that by telling us, or showing us, how the commentator has explained that really this is part of the story, and it's come to teach us about the king of Sodom, or to teach us about Avram. And the interesting P.S. to this, the postscript to this, is if you look in some of the academic and more open-minded liberal Christian commentaries today, is they generally side with Nechama. They don't quote her. They don't quote the Rashbam nor the Or HaChaim either, but they generally say that this is not an interpolation. It's one long story. And they show some literary patterns that work well with this. And they give the explanation that also, like the Rashbam, like the Abarbanel, that the story is coming to teach us about the king of Sodom. So the postscript is that some decades after Nechama proposed this, it's pretty much mainstream, even among academic and biblical critics, while in Nechama's time it was not. But again, she is responding to biblical critics without mentioning them, without even offering a suggestion. But once you read this, and then if you would ever see what the biblical critics say, you would have rejected it. Because you say, well, what do you mean? The Mefarshim, the commentators, have a perfect explanation for it. Well, let's move on to something that is Well, let me point out some criticisms that people have of Nechama Leibowitz. Number one is that she does not use much history, archaeology, or philology. She really sticks to the text and to the commentators. Even when she sticks to the commentators, as I pointed out as we went through the example, she doesn't speak chronologically. She has all the commentators mixed up. It's a big mishmash of all the commentators. She doesn't really look at them historically. When did they live? In what context did they live? And which commentators did they have in front of them? Right. So the Ramban did not have the Or HaChaim in front of him, because the Or HaChaim lived a few hundred years later. And the Rashbam didn't have the Ramban in front of him, because the Rashbam lived before him. So she doesn't look at that at all. She doesn't think that way at all. She thinks of all the commentators sitting down at a table together, debating and arguing. And personally, I love that. But that is a valid criticism that people have of her. Now, there's someone else, a contemporary of Nechama, who's still around today. And his name is Rabbi Yoel Ben-Nun, and he had a different approach. The two of them were the two major personalities in Tanakh for decades. And Nechama had her approach, and Rabbi Yoel Ben-Nun, his approach is different in a few ways. One of the ways is that he does not really deal with the commentaries. I'm not saying he doesn't know the commentaries. He does. He's a big Talmud Chacham. But when he teaches and when he writes, he just addresses the text itself, no commentaries. And he offers his own comment. Which is radically different from the way Nechama approaches the text. She sees the text and mainly with the commentaries. Well, Rabbi Yoel Ben-Nun doesn't address the commentaries at all. And another difference is that Rabbi Yoel Ben-Nun looks at the big picture. We said before that Nechama looked at a bigger picture. She looked at passages as a whole. Rabbi Yoel Ben-Nun looks at the Tanakh as a whole. He looks at major themes going throughout books. Throughout all the books, throughout all of Tanakh, he really looks at a very, very big picture. And another difference is that he looks at the realia. He's very interested in where things happen on a map, or in reality, what the botany, the zoology, that's very much what he focuses on. While Nechama was not really that interested in those sorts of things. Now, the two of them were friends and knew each other, but they did clash to some degree, because their approaches were very different, and Nechama did not believe that Rabbi Yoel Ben-Nun's approach was appropriate, certainly not for teaching high school students. While Rabbi Yoel Ben-Nun, he has his own, he's obviously an advocate for his own approach, and he has his own students. And I just want to mention one other big name from decades ago. That was Mordechai Breuer, who passed away a few years ago. He was in direct confrontation with the biblical critic. Okay, we seem to be having technical problems. I apologize for that. Rabbi Mordechai Breuer, let's... okay, we're losing a lot of time tonight. Let's try to... Okay, we're going to skip Rabbi Mordechai Breuer. That's not fair. So basically, in short, what he did was that he would look at the Torah and find multiple versions, as the biblical critics said that there were, and he agreed with their conclusions up to that point. But then he would say that all those versions are intentional. They all represent different attributes of God, different ways that God relates to humanity, and that's why there are different versions of stories and laws and narratives. In short, and it's very easily misunderstood, some people think that he actually fully accepted the idea that there are multiple versions of the Torah that were put together, and that's not true. He did not. He believed in Torah coming from Sinai, but he believed that when God gave the Torah, he intentionally put in different versions of various stories and laws. Very controversial. I don't buy it for a minute, but some people love that. And all of this I'm saying as an introduction to Rabbi Chanan Samet. Rabbi Chanan Samet was a student of Nechama Leibowitz, but he seems to me to mold together the three different approaches that we discussed so far. The approaches of Nechama Leibowitz, the approaches of Rabbi Yoel ben Nun, and the approaches of Rabbi Mordechai Breuer. And we'll give an example and you'll see what I mean. And that he directly addresses textual problems, not just through commentaries. And he answers with his own unique idea, his own chiddush, like Rabbi Yoel ben Nun does. But he uses commentaries and statements from the sages and midrashim to build up, to build his answer, to build his approach. So on the one hand, he's like Nechama that he surveys the commentaries. On the other, he's like Rabbi Yoel ben Nun in that he addresses the text directly and builds his own ideas from there. And he's like Rabbi Mordechai Breuer in that he very often addresses issues that biblical critics raise, but his answers are very different from Rabbi Mordechai Breuer. He does not suggest that there are different divine attributes in different stories. What he shows are that there are different themes and different ideas, and the text of the Torah is trying to teach multiple things at the same time, which to me, I enjoy this and I find it very convincing on many occasions. So let's look at one example from Rabbi Yochanan Samet. This is from the story of Korach in Bamidbar, Perek Tezayin, number 16. I don't have the whole thing up here. Instead, what I have is of Rabbi Yochanan Samet's summary of the different sections of this passage. The first section is verses 1 to 3. Where it's an opening, the coalition of the rebels and their common complaint against Moshe and Aaron. 4 to 7 is Moshe's first response to Korach and Tola's congregation, his proposal of the test that they all bring incense and whoever lights up, that's the one who God has chosen. Verses 8 to 11, Moshe's second response to Korach and to the Levim. Do you also seek the priesthood? Verses 12 to 15, Moshe's call to Dathan and Aviram. And they refusing to talk to him, and Moshe's response to them. And verses 16 to 19, Moshe returns to Korach and the proposal of the incense, and the beginning of the test, and Korach gathers his whole congregation. In verses 20 to 22, God says he will punish the congregation, and Moshe and Aaron pray to cancel the punishment. Verses 23 to 27, Moshe tells the congregation to move away from the tents of the rebels. Verses 27 to 34, Moshe announces the punishment that is coming, and then they're swallowed up by the earth. Verse 35, the 250 princes who hold the incense, they're burnt. They're killed through burning. And then afterwards, in chapter 17, verses 1 to 5, the melting of the pans that held the incense into a covering for the altar. So here are the questions. There are many questions that come up in this passage. Okay. Because it really seems like there are two different stories here interwoven together. Who was Korach with? Was he with 250 princes, or was he with the Levim? Seems like at some points in the story, it seems like he's with one group. At other points, it seems like he's with the other group. Now look, let me see if I can point here. Here. Moshe talks to Korach and his congregation, and he gives the test of the incense. Okay, good. So what happens next? Moshe talks to them again. Well, why does he have to talk to them again? He talks to the Levim. And says, do you also seek the priesthood? He just already proposed a test. So why does he talking to the Levim again? And then Moshe goes to Dathan and Aviram and speaks to them. But why is all this necessary? He already proposed a test with the incense. Why does he have to speak to the Levim and speak to Dathan and Aviram? Seems to be out of order. Seems to be unnecessary. And then look at the punishments. It's swallowed into the earth. But then wait a second. 250 the princes are burnt. So which punishment is the right one? Is the real one that happened? Were they swallowed by the earth, or were they burned? So Rabbi Chana Samet does not tell you that the biblical critics see two sources here, but it's pretty clear. He makes it pretty clear that that's what's going on. You have to be totally unaware of biblical criticism to realize they're talking about two different versions of the story, and that there aren't biblical critics hiding behind the curtain over there. But one thing that he does do is he goes through the different approaches of the Rishonim, of the commentaries. He goes through Ibn Ezra, he goes through Rabbi Nechanan, he goes through the Ramban to try to explain who Korach was with. And then Rabbi Samet offers his own approach. And his own approach is fairly simple, and that's that the text, when you look at the text as having either one version or another, what you're really doing is you're trying to look at it simplistically, as if there's one very simple story to tell. It's like we're back in fifth grade, and the story has the good guys and the bad guys, and it goes chronologically, very simple. The good guys fight the good guys win, the bad guys are dead, everybody celebrates. That's not how the real world works. In the real world, especially when we talk about a rebellion against a political leader, it's very complicated. There are people grouped together for many different reasons. You have one leader, and the strength of a good leader is that he can lead very different types of groups together, and he is the one person at the top. That's how you have a successful leader. Otherwise, you'll be a leader of five people who all say the same thing. If you're going to be a leader of a large group of people, you have to have different subgroups, and you have to be able to deal with them. And Korach was that talented, skillful person who could bring together groups with different agendas and different motivations, and he could still lead them in a rebellion against Moshe. That's the way real rebellions work. You have different subgroups with different agendas. So what's going on here is that Moshe is responding to the various different subgroups underneath Korach, trying to get them all together into one test. He proposes a test with the incense, and then he goes to all the others, to one subgroup, the Korach and one subgroup, and then he goes to all the other subgroups, the Levim, the Dathan and Aviram, and trying to get them to join with Korach and that subgroup with the 250 princes, so that Moshe can respond to all of them at once. And then what happens? Even at the time of the test, they're not all standing together. If they were all standing together, they all would have been swallowed by the earth. So they still have the subgroups sitting, standing in different places. Moshe does the test. Moshe wins. And one group is swallowed up. That's the Levim. And that's Dathan and Aviram. Because what would the Levim really want? What were they up to? What were they up to? The Levim did not oppose the fact that there was such an idea of priests who served God in the service. They just wanted to be us, to be them. Why not us? We should be the priests and not someone else. So Levim, they had a grab for power. As opposed to the princes, they wanted everyone to be equal. They wanted everyone to be on the same level, and that's a very different idea than what the Levim had, but it was still a rebellion, so they were joined together in this rebellion, and the punishment reflects what they were trying to do. The princes, who really wanted to rise up and reach out to God, so they were doing it the wrong way, but they were punished through fire that came down from heaven. The Levim, who were trying to protest, who were trying to create some rebellion for just really mundane reasons, it was a grab for power, so they were swallowed up by the earth in punishment for their earthly mundane rebellion. And that's the way Rabbi Chana Samet responds, on the one hand, to biblical criticism. On the other hand, he responds to what the text, he's really responding to the text, and all the points in the text that lead you away from a simple understanding of it. And he looks through the commentaries, just like Nechama Leibowitz would have him do. But he comes up with his own very unique and original approach, just like Rabbi Yoel Ben Nun would do. And that's Rabbi Chana Samet. So now we move on to the books we're supposed to talk about with less than 20 minutes left, and I apologize for that. So let's move on to Rabbi Etshalom's book, Between the Lines of the Bible. Again, I had a large role in the publication of this book. Rabbi Etshalom I find him to be very similar to Rabbi Samet in many of his approaches. Rabbi Samet, so far, he's published two series of books, of two volumes in each series, going through all the different weekly Torah portions. So he has one set with two volumes that goes from the beginning to the end, and then another set from beginning to end. And last time I talked to him, which was a few years ago, he told me he was working on a third set. I don't know if that's out in Israel yet or not. I haven't seen it in the U.S. So Rabbi Echelon, this book is only on the book of Genesis, on Bereshis. He has another one on Shmos coming out very, very soon, which I look forward to. And he has a lot of the same approaches as Rabbi Samet, of joining together, on the one hand, Nechama Leibowitz, on the other hand, Rabbi Yoel Ben-Nun, and on the other hand, Rabbi Mordechai Breuer. In that, like Nechama Leibowitz, Rabbi Echelon goes through a lot of the commentaries and is very involved with the commentaries and what do they mean. And he looks for the textual cues that bring the commentaries to the commentators to their conclusions and their approaches. On the other hand, he looks at major themes throughout Tanakh. And he quotes, he jumps around from place to place, from here to there, try to bring everything together, like Rabbi Yoel Ben-Nun, and he always comes up with very interesting, creative understandings of the text. But, like Rabbi Mordechai Breuer, very often he responds directly to biblical critics. And you can see this very clearly in this book, Between the Lines of the Bible, when I think three of the chapters are called Responding to the Biblical Critics, 1, 2, and 3. So I have an example from Rabbi Echelon that I was going to do, but it looks like I'm going to skip that right now. But if you look at your handouts, that's the third example, talking about Shimon and Levi. And what you see there is you see on the one hand bringing different proofs from going beyond the one simple passage of Shimon and Levi attacking Shechem. Was it a good thing or a bad thing? Going beyond that simple passage of Genesis 34 and looking out of places in the Torah and Tanakh. Coming up with an interesting backstory that explains the motivations of everyone going on, that's going on there. And furthermore, an approach that sounds very Zionistic, in that he says, here's his basic explanation. He says, Yaakov did not so much oppose the fact that Shimon and Levi went out and killed all the people of Shechem. Why was Yaakov opposed to it? Because Yaakov grew up as the son of Yitzhak and the grandson of Avram. He saw that Avram and Yitzhak were scared of the locals when they went to Egypt, or to Gerar, when they had to hide their wife and say, oh, she's really my sister, and then the sister was taken away, the wife slash sister was taken away by the king. And at no point did Avram or Yitzhak pick up their swords and start fighting. They didn't. They never did that. They kind of sat back and said, I got to do whatever I have to do. And so Yaakov was very much like that. He just came from living in exile for over 20 years, coming into Israel, into what was in many ways a foreign land. So he was scared, and he just sat back, and he said, look, if they're going to take our daughter, there's nothing I can do about it. What am I supposed to do? Whereas Shimon and Levi, they were young people, young, confident, coming in to conquer and to do whatever they have to do. They pick up their swords, and they defended their sister and defended their family honor. And as Rabbi Echelon tries to prove, the conclusion of Tanakh is of the Torah and Tanakh was that Shimon and Levi were correct. Now, from a religious Zionist perspective, for any Zionist perspective, you can see what he's trying to say, and that's it's okay to defend yourself. It's okay to come in and conquer the land. But on the other hand, whether that value is true or not true, and whether it's contemporary or not contemporary, Rabbi Echelon tries to prove it from a textual perspective with the commentaries as well. Now I want to move on from Rabbi Echelon to Rabbi Moshe Lichtenstein. Briefly, Rabbi Moshe Lichtenstein has a book. So I don't actually think I have the cover here. I'll go back to the book list then. Rabbi Moshe Lichtenstein has a book called Moses, Envoy of God, Envoy of His People. And there are four parts to this book. The first three discuss... No, I don't have it sitting next to me. I have every other book next to me, but not that book. First three discuss different stages in Moshe's life. I believe the first stage is until Mount Sinai. The second stage is at Sinai. Second part is at Sinai. And the third part is in Moab, in Arvos Moab. And I'm not going to talk about that. The fourth part of the book is what I found the most interesting. Everybody has their own interests. The fourth is all about methodology. What is his approach to reading Tanakh, to reading Torah, and what is his approach to commentary? And there are two sections to that, within that fourth section. The first section is about the difference between Pshat and Midrash, and where does he stand on that. And The second is about the human characteristics of the characters in the Bible, like we discussed before. And in short, his approach is that when it comes to the characters of the Bible, they have human characteristics. There's a psychology, there's an emotion to them, and he is fine with that. But the first section is something that I don't truly understand, and I have a friend right now in Yeshivat Har Zion, Rav Moshe Lichtenstein, as I said, is a Rosh Yeshiva there. My friend sits next to him in the Beis Medrash. So I emailed him and said, could you please ask Rabbi Lichtenstein, what does he mean in this one subsection of section 4 in the book? So he asked him, and all I got back is that I misunderstood it. Rabbi Chaim Angel had criticized or critiqued Rabbi Lichtenstein's approach, which I'll explain in a minute. And Rabbi Lichtenstein said that he believes Rabbi Angel misunderstood him, and he's in the process of writing a response. I look forward to that response when it's published. So what I understood, and Rabbi Angel independently understood, is that Rabbi Lichtenstein says the difference between pshat and drash is as follows. Well, actually, I'll read it to you. Pshat undertakes to explain the text and the plot presented in it, whereas drash does not simply analyze the existing story, but develops it and adds new dimensions beyond the simple meaning of the text. The Midrash does not explain what is already there, but complements the text by adding elements that were not there previously. Midrash adds backstory. Text, pshat is what's in the text. Midrash is what fills in between the text. The backstory, the conversations that aren't in there. Not every word that is said can be recorded in the text. So what's not said? So the Midrash adds that, adds the backstory, adds the approaches and the ideas and the things going in their minds. So Rabbi Lichtenstein adds that some midrashim are so widely accepted that they become standard. You must accept them and you must follow them. And then, from what I understand, he seems to back off from that a little bit. How much he backs off is not clear, and that's where he says that Rabbi Angel, and presumably I misunderstood him, and I wait for clarification. But what I thought was very interesting here is that from his definition of pshat in Midrash, a lot of what we've said tonight already, a lot of what Rabbi Echelon does, Rabbi Samet does, what Rabbi Yoel ben Nun does, and to some degree what Nechama Leibowitz does, is not pshat, it's Midrash. Now, in some places, those are fighting words. I could get in trouble for suggesting that. I know Rabbi Echelon, who I believe gives a class on Torah in Motion, would be upset with me for saying that, and I hope he forgives me. But from this definition by Rav Moshe Lichtenstein, not everything in the new school is considered pshat. And I actually, I heard that once when I was trying to explain when I was in the process of publishing Rabbi Echelon's book. So I described it to a Rosh Yeshiva, and he said to me, ah, the new Midrash. And I said, no, it's pshat. And he said, no, the new Midrash. And it took me a while, I had to think about it, and then I finally understood what he meant, and that's what Rabbi Lichtenstein is saying, and that when you add backstory, when you add motivations, what's motivating Yaakov, and what's motivating the brothers, that's not in the text. If it's not in the text, that's Midrash. Not that there's anything wrong with it. Midrash is wonderful also. Let's move on to Rabbi Chaim Angel, because we're running out of time. Again, partially my fault, and I apologize for that. Let me see, I have two images here. Here we go. That's a bad one. Let me get to the good one. Okay, you can see a little bit better. These are the covers to his two books. One book is Through an Opaque Lens. It was published by the Sephardic Publication Foundation, which is really his shul. Rabbi Angel, you should know, is one of the most popular teachers, if not the most popular teacher at YU. His classes in Tanakh are packed. I know people who have already graduated but still come audit the class anyway when they're in graduate school or in rabbinical school. He's a very popular lecturer. So he has two books that he's published so far. Through an Opaque Lens, a few years ago, Revealed Text, Hidden Meanings. I always stumble over that, and I immediately think of that movie Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. That's what I think of his book, is Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon on the Chumash. So Rabbi Angel is a collection of his essays. His essays are fabulous for two reasons, because he has two types of essays. One is on methodology, in which he reviews some of the other people that we've been talking about, and others in addition to that. He has reviews on the approaches of Nechama Leibowitz, the approaches of Rabbi Yoel ben Nun, the approaches of Rabbi Chanan Samet, which are fascinating in themselves. And then he has his own textual studies. And what I've been trying to do is figure out, where does he fit in? Who is he a student of? And to the best of my ability. I never took a class with him, although I've spoken with him quite a few times. I believe he is a very good, faithful student of Nechama Leibowitz. And that when he addresses a topic, he covers the commentaries, he discusses what textual cues drove the commentaries to their conclusions, and he compares and contrasts them. He tries to find contemporary relevance. What theology can I get from this? What idea that I can apply to my personal life can I get from this without compromising the commentaries and the text? He does not usually, some people will be disappointed in his essays because he doesn't have a chiddush, he doesn't have some fabulous insight like Rabbi Yoel ben Nun does or Rabbi Hanan Samet. That's not how Rabbi Angel works. What he does is he slowly builds up ideas through the text and through the commentaries, which is very much like Nechama Leibowitz does. When I first read Nechama Leibowitz's studies, I was so disappointed. I read it and I said, well, she's just quoting commentaries. You know, that's boring. I can look at the commentaries myself. What do I need her for? Now, the truth is, eventually I came to appreciate it a little more, that she's got a point. She's finding the textual cues, and she's building something up by putting all the commentaries and all the different passages next to each other. But there is no flash of insight. There's no passion and tears, you know, big question and the big answer. They don't do that. Rabbi Angel, Nechama doesn't do that, and Rabbi Angel doesn't do that either. They build things up slowly. That said, I want to go move on and kind of look back at all the different people that we've talked about in general and offer some general criticisms or critiques or thoughts on it. Number one, and something that we already mentioned before with the Moshe Lichtenstein, how much of this is really pshat? And it's not clear to me that all of it is. Despite the protests to the contrary, a lot of these ideas are very speculative, are very based in the air, up in the air ideas and motivations and stories not in the text, which is Midrash. There's nothing wrong with doing that, but you should be aware of what it is. Furthermore, a lot of these essays are not very rigorous. They would not fly in the academic world. Not that everything said in the academic world is pure truth. It's not. But in the academic world, you have to try to anticipate the criticisms people will have of your study, before they offer those criticisms, you have to try to respond to it. You have to build the case from beginning to end, show how you got from point A to point B, why, and justify it. A lot of these are not justified. They're just speculations, maybe this, maybe that. Again, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, I'd call that drush, good drush, text-based drush. Not necessarily pshat and not necessarily rigorous. To some degree, you see religious Zionist values and modern values imposed onto the text. Does that mean the text doesn't say it? Does that mean the values aren't right? I'm sure what they would say, what whoever offered this idea would say, is that because the values are true, that's why they can be found in the text. I'm not so sure about that. If you read broadly enough and widely enough, you'll see people from opposing ideologies explaining the text according to their ideologies. And to some degree, you see that in this literature also. Whether it's liberal, whether it's religiously questioning. The example I have here in the handouts from Reb Chaim Angel, which we can't cover because we don't have time, is like that also. His conclusion is, he looks through all the different cases of Avram responding to God and all the times that Avram questions God, particularly in Sodom. Avram said, how could you kill the righteous and the wicked together? And there are other times where it seems that Avram is questioning God, you know, how will I know that I will inherit it? Where, you know, who's going to take over my legacy? And then Rabbi Angel says, ask the following question. If Avram was so comfortable with questioning God, how come when God told him to take his son and sacrifice him, he didn't question God there? How come when God told him to send away Yishmael, his son, his oldest son, his firstborn, told him to send him away and banish him, why didn't Avram ask there? So what Rabbi Angel explains is that there are different ways that Avram reacted. There are times when he was commanded to do something, and when Avram is commanded to do something by God, he does it. There are other times where God promises him something, and when God promises Avram something, so in that case, sometimes he thanks God and praises him, and other times he challenges him. How do I know that this promise is going to come true? It's not a command. Commands he always fulfills. Promises he reacts differently. And when it comes to this, he's stuck in situations where he doesn't know what to do. There's no communication, so at that point, he uses his best judgment. And then Rebbe Angel takes these three things, these three categories, and applies it to our daily life. When we have a command, when you have halacha, when halacha tells us to do something, you have to do it. You can't ask questions. But when you're dealing with theological issues, promises, ideas, theories, at that point, it's perfectly okay to ask questions and to challenge God. Challenging God at that point is following Avram's example. And when you don't have any guidance, religious guidance on what to do, so at that point you use your best judgment. So again, what you see is a grappling with the text, an honest grappling with the text, a very good question, and an answer that to some degree takes what I believe are Rabbi Angel's values and applying it to the text. Is it valid or is it not valid? That's a separate question. You could very much argue that it is entirely valid and is a correct reading of the text. But you could also argue that it's Rabbi Angel imposing his own values on the text. And you see that done to some degree. Another thing you see a lot is that there's very limited use of archaeology and philology by many of these people in the New School. Now, they often say, we use archaeology and we use philology. But how true that is, it's not clear to me. I don't see it too much. And when they do use archaeology, it does not seem to me to be cutting edge. They seem to be decades behind wherever the field is right now. Maybe because it's not their specialty, but maybe it should be. And finally, I want to make one point, and that's you see almost no use of Christian commentaries at all. And now, in the times of Nechama Leibowitz, certainly when she was in her prime, that's mainly because the Christian commentaries were not very good. Either they were very critical of the Bible and didn't offer much in terms of commentary, or they were very fundamentalist Christian and did not offer much in commentary that we could use either. Nowadays, that's not the case. It hasn't been the case for probably 30 years. There's a huge amount of good Christian material that is generally consistent with Jewish approaches. And I look at it and I find many, many good insights and many things that are very consistent with what this New School has to say. And as I mentioned briefly before, Nechama Leibowitz had her approach to this story of Malki Tzedek. When I looked in a Christian commentary, he took that same approach, but he added even more. And so that even strengthened Nechama's point. And, you know, it's a shame that she didn't have it available. One reason is because it was only published in the 80s, the commentary I looked at. But her students, I don't see them using too much Christian. When I look in Rabbi Angel's, I did a quick flip through the endnotes of a bunch of chapters, and I didn't see anything Christian. He did quote some non-traditional Jews, like Nechama did, but I didn't see anything Christian in there at all. For better or for worse, I would encourage people who are competent, certainly like Rabbi Angel is. He's not a competent, he's a giant in the field. There's much to be learned there. Now, does anybody have any questions? Because I could keep on talking for a long time, even though we ran out of time. So now is the time, if anybody has any questions to ask. I see someone typing. Okay. Let me tell you two reasons. I started out at the beginning saying it's very timely, but then I totally neglected to mention why it's very timely. Number one, there's a new tradition out. I have not yet received it. The journal tradition put out by RCA, the Rabbinical Council of America. I haven't received it, but they just put it on their website today. And if you're a subscriber, you can download articles. So there's one article there with an actual exchange. That argument that we discussed between Nechama Leibowitz and Rabbi Yoel Ben Nun was continued literally today by two writers in the journal tradition, Rabbi Yaakov Blau. Yanki Blau is the youngest son of Rabbi Yosef Blau and Dr. Rivka Blau from YU. So he was taking really the approach of Nechama Leibowitz, saying you got to stick to the commentaries. Don't go off coming up with your own interesting ideas up in the air. Stick to the commentaries and to the text through the commentaries. While Rabbi Yaakov Beasley, who teaches in Eretz Yisrael, he teaches Tanakh, he's more of a Rabbi Yoel Ben Nun type. He had written a review of two books in a previous issue of Tradition, to which Rabbi Blau was responding. And Rabbi Beasley really makes a case for Rabbi Yoel Ben Nun's approach, saying how we have to be original, we have to deal with the real things, go out into the field, look at the plants and the places, and make the Tanakh come alive by seeing the real things and the real places. And you have to look at the whole Tanakh, you can't look at just isolated passages. So it's really that argument from decades ago between Nechama Leibowitz and Rabbi Yoel Ben Nun continued to this day. I found that very timely, very interesting. The other thing is that there are two new books which I just received in the mail today from the authors. which I have not looked at. Well, one I sort of looked. This is called, let me see if you can see it, Jacob's Family Dynamics by Gad Dishi. I read this a few years ago in manuscript when I was considering publishing it, and I struggled over it. I wanted to publish it, but I just couldn't. I didn't have the bandwidth. I didn't have the time. And he finally got it published. It's a very psychological and literary discussion of the Yaakov life story. It's some 200 pages all about Yaakov's family. Brilliant, beautiful. I mean, from what I remember from a few years ago, really, really opened my eyes to very many interesting questions from the Pshat, maybe a little Midrash in there, but very literary, very, very thoughtful. The other is called Dawn of Redemption by Rabbi Dr. Meir Levin, a friend of mine. I published a previous book by him. This is his commentary, his psychological commentaries on the books of Ruth and Yonah, Rus and Yonah. He is a medical doctor, but a very sensitive reader of Tanakh. He is more traditional in his use of commentaries. Both Gad Dishi and Meir Levin use traditional commentaries, but Gad Dishi moves out to literary scholars like Robert Alter and Meir Sternberg, while Dr. Levin uses traditional commentaries like the Netziv and the Ramban, and that's where he focuses, the Malbim, that's where he really focuses out. Both. Okay, some questions here. Rav Samit, is his own school? I don't think the jury is out on that. He considers himself a student to be of Nechama Leibowitz, I believe. I've only spoken to him two or three times. That's what I gathered. On the other hand, I had thought that he was a student of Rabbi Mordechai Breuer. And then after thinking about it, I saw really more connection between him and Rabbi Yoel ben Nun. So is he his own school or not? I don't know. But he's, of all the people we discussed tonight, he speaks to me personally the most. I enjoy his stuff, and I find his stuff more convincing than anyone else. His sets are not available in English. I had tried a few years ago to get it translated. I couldn't raise the money. If anyone wants to discuss it with me, feel free to email me or contact me any way you can. I would love to get Rav Samit's material translated into English. There's a partial, abridged translation on vbmtorah.org, vbm-torah.org. That's a virtual Beit Midrash. It's not as faithful to the Hebrew as I would want. They're not available in English. The Hebrew ones, I bought in Brooklyn, in Eichler's and Flatbush. They might still be there. Rabbi Etchalom considers himself a student of Rabbi Liebtag. Okay, could be. I thought he considered himself a student of Rabbi Samit. I could be wrong. Does it matter how we define Pshat? Yes and no. You have to be true to, when you're talking about Pshat, there's an assumption that you will be very, very true to the details of the text. You won't go off into speculation and beyond the text. Now, if you're saying that you're doing Pshat, and then you're going off beyond the text, you're making a claim that you're not living up to. You know, if you're going to write the check, you got to pay for it. If you're going to claim, I'm doing Pshat, you got to stick to that. Otherwise, don't make the claim, and don't criticize other people who don't do Pshat. Yoel ben Nun, is it available in English? No, I'm aware that there is an effort, a lot of translation has been done, and there is an effort to get it published in English. I'm not sure the status of that and how much has been translated, but I believe Rabbi Yoel ben Nun's material will be found in English within the next few years. Hopefully Rav Samit's will as well. Nechama Leibowitz's material has been in English for a long time. And what we're finding now is the people writing to begin with in English, people like Rabbi Angel and Rabbi Etchalom. And hopefully we'll see a lot more of that. And we also have Gad Dishi and Dr. Meir Levin now in English. And I look forward to more of this in the years to come. So I want to thank everyone for sticking around here despite the technical difficulties. It was a tough night. But I hope you gained something from this and you enjoyed it. Thank you very much. And have a good night, and we'll meet here again next week.